Side 1, RC 52924, City of Golden Shadow, Other Land, Volume 1, by Tad Williams, copyright 1996 by Tad Williams, read by Eric Sandvold. This book contains 770 pages on 24 sides. Foreword. It started in mud, as many things do. In a normal world, it would have been time for breakfast, but apparently breakfast was not served in hell. The bombardment that had begun before dawn showed no signs of letting up. Private Jonas did not feel much like eating anyway, except for a brief moment of terrified retreat across a patch of muddy ground, cratered and desolate as the moon. Paul Jonas had spent all of this 24th day of March, 1918, as he had spent the 3 days before, and most of the past several months, crouched shivering in cold, stinking slime, somewhere between Ypres and Saint-Quentin, deafened by the skull-rattling thunder of the German heavy guns, praying reflexively to something in which he no longer believed. He had lost Finch and Mullet and the rest of the platoon somewhere in the chaos of retreat. He hoped they'd made it safely into some other part of the trenches, but it was hard to think about anything much beyond his own few cubits of misery. The entire world was wet and sticky. The torn earth, the skeletal trees, and Paul himself had been abundantly spattered by the slow-falling mist that followed hundreds of pounds of red-hot metal exploding in a crowd of human beings. Red fog, gray earth, sky the color of old bones. Paul Jonas was in hell. But it was a very special hell. Not everyone in it was dead yet. In fact, Paul noted, one of its residents was dying very slowly indeed. By the sound of the man's voice, he could not be more than 24 yards away, but he might as well have been in Timbuktu. Paul had no idea what the wounded soldier looked like. He could no more have voluntarily lifted his head above the lip of the trench than he could have willed himself to fly, but he was all too familiar with the man's voice, which had been cursing, sobbing and squealing in agony for a full hour, filling every lull between the crash of the guns. All the rest of the men who had been hit during the retreat had shown the good manners to die quickly, or at least to suffer quietly. Paul's invisible companion had screamed for his sergeant, his mother, and God, and when none of them had come for him, had kept on screaming anyway. He was screaming still, a sobbing, wordless wail. Once, a faceless doughboy like thousands of others, the wounded man now seemed determined to make everyone on the Western Front bear witness to his dying moments. Paul hated him. The terrible thumping roar subsided. There was a glorious moment of silence before the wounded man began to shriek again, piping like a boiling lobster. "Go to light!" Paul turned. Pale, beer-yellow eyes peered from a mask of mud beside him. The apparition, crouched on hands and knees, wore a greatcoat so tattered it seemed made from cobwebs. "What? Go to light! A match!" The normality of the question, in the midst of so much that was unreal, left Paul wondering if he had heard correctly. The figure lifted a hand as muddy as the face, displaying a thin white cylinder so luminously clean that it might have dropped from the moon. "Can you hear, fellow? A light?" Paul reached into his pocket and fumbled with numbed fingers until he found a box of matches, miraculously dry. The wounded soldier began howling even louder, lost in the wilderness a stone's throw away. The man in the ragged greatcoat tipped himself against the side of the trench, fitting the curve of his back into the sheltering mud, then delicately pulled the cigarette into two pieces, and handed one to Paul. As he lit the match, he tilted his head to listen. "God help me, he's still going on up there!" He passed the matches back and held the flame steady so Paul could light his own cigarette. "Why couldn't Fritz drop one on him and give us all a little peace?" Paul nodded his head. Even that was an effort. His companion lifted his chin and let out a dribble of smoke which curled up past the rim of his helmet and vanished against the flat morning sky. "Do you ever get the feeling, that it's a mistake?" The stranger wagged his head to indicate the trenches, the German guns, all of the Western Front. "That God's away, or having a bit of a sleep or something. Don't you find yourself hoping that one day you'll look down and see what's happening and do something about it?" Paul nodded, although he had never thought the matter through in such detail. But he had felt the emptiness of the gray skies, and had occasionally had a curious sensation of looking down on the blood and mud from a great distance, observing the murderous deeds of war with the detachment of a man standing over an anthill. God could not be watching. That was certain. If he was, and if he had seen the things Paul Jonas had seen, men who were dead but didn't know it, frantically trying to push their spilled guts back into their blouses, bodies swollen and fly-blown, lying unretrieved for days within yards of friends with whom they had sung and laughed. If he had seen all that but not interfered, then he must be insane. But Paul had never for a moment believed that God would save the tiny creatures slaughtering each other by the thousands over an acre of shell-pocked mud. That was too much like a fairy tale. Beggar boys did not marry princesses. They died in snowy streets or dark alleys, or in muddy trenches in France, while old Papa God took a long rest. He summoned up his strength. "Heard anything?" The stranger drew deeply on his cigarette, unconcerned that the ember was burning against his muddy fingers, and sighed. "Everything. Nothing, you know. Fritz is breaking through in the south, and he'll go right on to Paris. Oh, now the Yanks are in it, we're going to roll them right up and march to Berlin by June. The winged victory of Samer-what's-it appeared in the skies over Flanders, waving a flaming sword and dancing the hoochie coo. It's all shit. It's all shit," Paul agreed. He drew once more on his own cigarette, and then dropped it into a puddle. He watched sadly as muddy water wicked into the paper, and the last fragments of tobacco floated free. How many more cigarettes would he smoke before death found him? A dozen? A hundred? Or might that one be his last? He picked up the paper and squeezed it into a tight ball between his finger and thumb. "Thanks, mate." The stranger rolled over and began crawling away up the trench, then shouted something odd over his shoulder. "Keep your head down. Try to think about getting out. About really getting out." Paul lifted his hand in a farewell wave, although the man could not see him. The wounded soldier topside was shouting again, wordless, grunting cries that sounded like something inhuman giving birth. Within moments, as though wakened by demonic invocation, the guns started up again. Paul clenched his teeth and tried to stop up his ears with his hands, but he could still hear the man screaming. The rasping voice was like a hot wire going in one ear hole and out the other, sawing back and forth. He had snatched perhaps 3 hours of sleep in the last 2 days, and the night fast approaching seemed sure to be even worse. Why hadn't any of the stretcher teams gone out to bring back the wounded man? The guns had been silent for at least an hour. But as he thought about it, Paul realized that except for the man who had come begging a light, he had not seen anyone else since they had all fled the forward trenches that morning. He had assumed that there were others just a few bends down, and the man with the cigarette had seemed to confirm that. But the bombardment had been so steady that Paul had felt no desire to move. Now that things had been quiet a while, he was beginning to wonder what was happening to the rest of the platoon. Had Finch and the rest all fallen back to an earlier series of scrapes, or were they just a few yards down the line, hugging the depths, unwilling to face the open killing ground even on a mission of mercy? He slid forward onto his knees and tipped his helmet back so it would not slide over his eyes, then began to crawl westward. Even well below the top of the trench, he felt his own movement to be a provocative act. He hunched his shoulders in expectation of some terrible blow from above. Yet nothing came down on him but the ceaseless wail of the dying man. 20 yards and 2 bends later, he reached a wall of mud. Paul tried to wipe away the tears, but only succeeded in pushing dirt into his eyes. A last explosion echoed above, and the ground shook in sympathy. A gob of mud on one of the roots protruding into the trench quivered, fell, and became an indistinguishable part of the greater muddiness below. He was trapped. That was the simple, horrible fact. Unless he braved the unprotected ground above, he could only huddle in his sealed-off section of trench until a shell found him. He had no illusions that he would last long enough for starvation to become a factor. He had no illusions at all. He was as good as dead. He would never again listen to Mullet complaining about rations, or watch old Finch trimming his mustache with a pocket-knife. Such small things, so homely. But he already missed them so badly that it hurt. The dying man was still out there, still howling. "This is hell, nor am I out of it." What was that from? A poem? The Bible? He unsnapped his holster and drew his Webley, then lifted it toward his eye. In the failing light, the hole in its barrel seemed deep as a well. an emptiness into which he could fall and never come out, a silent, dark, restful emptiness. Paul smiled a bleak little smile, then carefully laid the pistol in his lap. It would be unpatriotic, surely. Better to force the Germans to use up their expensive shells on him, squeeze a few more working hours out of some model-armed Fräulein on a factory line in the Ruhr Valley. Besides, there was always hope, wasn't there? He began weeping once more. Above, the wounded man stopped screeching for a moment to cough. He sounded like a dog being whipped. Paul leaned his head back against the mud and bellowed, "Shut it! Shut it, for Christ's sake!" He took a deep breath. "Shut your mouth and die, damn you!" Apparently encouraged by companionship, the man resumed screaming. Night seemed to last a year or more. Months of darkness. Great blocks of immovable black. The guns sputtered and shouted. The dying man wailed. Paul counted every single individual object he could remember from his life before the trenches, then started over and counted them again. He remembered only the names of some of them, but not what the names actually meant. Some words seemed impossibly strange. Lawn chair was one, bathtub another. Garden was mentioned in several songs in the chaplain's hymn book, but Paul was fairly certain it was a real thing as well, so he counted it. "Try to think about getting out," the yellow-eyed man had said. "About really getting out." The guns were silent. The sky had gone a slightly paler shade, as though someone had wiped it with a dirty rag. There was just enough light for Paul to see the edges of the trench. He clambered up and then slid back, laughing silently at the up and down of it all. Getting out. He found a thick root with his foot and heaved himself onto the rim of the earthwork. He had his gun. He was going to kill the man who was screaming. He didn't know much more than that. Somewhere the sun was coming up, although Paul had no idea where exactly that might be happening. The effect was small and smeared across a great, dull expanse of sky. Beneath that sky everything was gray, mud and water. He knew the water was the flat places, so everything else was mud, except perhaps for the tall things. Yes, those were trees, he remembered. Had been trees. Paul stood up and turned in a slow circle. The world extended for only a few hundred yards in any direction before ending in mist. He was marooned in the center of an empty space, as though he had wandered onto a stage by mistake, and now stood before a silent, expectant audience. But he was not entirely alone. Halfway across the emptiness, one tree stood by itself, a clawing hand with a twisted bracelet of barbed wire. Something dark hung in its denuded branches. Paul drew his revolver and staggered toward it. It was a figure, hanging upside down like a discarded marionette, one leg caught in the high angle of bough and trunk. All its joints seemed to have been broken, and the arms dangled downward, fingers reaching, as though muck were heaven, and it was struggling to fly. The front of its head was a tattered, featureless mass of red and scorched black and gray, except for one bright, staring yellow eye, mad and intent as a bird's eye, which watched his slow approach. "I got out," Paul said. He lifted his gun, but the man was not screaming now. A hole opened in the ruined face. It spoke. "You've come at last. I've been waiting for you." Paul stared. The butt of the gun was slippery in his fingers. His arm trembled with the effort of keeping it raised. "Waiting?"
"Waiting. Waiting so long."
The mouth, empty but for a few white shards floating in red, twisted in an upside-down smile.
"Do you ever get the feeling?"
Paul winced as the screaming began again, but it could not be the dying man. This was the dying man. "So, feeling?" he asked, then looked up. The dark shape was tumbling down the sky toward him, a black hole in the dull gray air, whistling as it came. The dull thump of the howitzer followed a moment later, as though time had turned and bitten its own tail.
"That it's a mistake,"
said the hanging man, and then the shell struck, and the world folded in on itself, smaller and smaller, angle after angle creased with fire and then compressed along its axes until it all vanished. Things became even more complicated after Paul died. He was dead, of course, and he knew it. How could he be anything else? He had seen the howitzer shell diving down on him from the sky. a wingless, eyeless, breathtakingly modern angel of death, streamlined and impersonal as a shark. He had felt the world convulse and the air catch fire, felt his lungs raped of oxygen and charred to cracklings in his chest. There could be no doubt that he was dead. But why did his head hurt? Of course, an afterlife in which the punishment for a misspent existence was an eternally throbbing headache might make a sort of sense, a horrible sort of sense. Paul opened his eyes and blinked at the light. He was sitting upright on the rim of a vast crater, a surely mortal wound ripped deep into the muddy earth. The land around it was flat and empty. There were no trenches, or if there were, they were buried under the outflingings of the explosion. He could see nothing but churned mud in any direction, until the earth itself blurred into gray-gleaming mist along the encircling horizon. But something solid was behind him, propping him up, and the sensation of it against the small of his back and his shoulder blades made him wonder for the first time whether he had anticipated death too soon. As he tilted his head back to look, his helmet brim tipped forward over his eyes, returning him to darkness for a moment, then slid down over his face and onto his lap. He stared at the helmet. Most of its crown was gone, blasted away, the torn and tortured metal of the brim resembling nothing so much as a crown of thorns. Remembering horror tales of shell-blasted soldiers who walked 24 yards without their heads, or held their own innards in their hands without recognizing what they were, Paul shivered convulsively. Slowly, as though playing a grisly game with himself, he ran his fingers up his face, past his cheeks and temples, feeling for what must be the pulped top of his own skull. He touched hair, skin, and bone, but all in their proper places. No wound. When he held his hands before his face, they were striped with as much blood as mud, but the red was dry already, old paint and powder. He let out a long-held breath. He was dead, but his head hurt. He was alive, but a red-hot shell fragment had ripped through his helmet like a knife through cake frosting. Paul looked up and saw the tree, the small, skeletal thing that had drawn him across no man's land, the tree where the dying man had hung. Now it stretched up through the clouds. Paul Jonas sighed. He had walked around the tree 5 times, and it showed no sign of becoming any less impossible. The frail, leafless thing had grown so large that its top was out of sight beyond the clouds that hung motionless in the gray sky. Its trunk was as wide as a castle tower from a fairy story, a massive cylinder of rough bark that seemed to extend as far downward as it did up, running smoothly down the side of the bomb crater, vanishing into the soil at the bottom with no trace of roots. He had walked around the tree and could make no sense of it. He had walked away from the tree, hoping to find an angle from which he could gauge its height, but that had not assisted his understanding either. No matter how far he stumbled back across the featureless plain, the tree still stretched beyond the cloud ceiling. And always, whether he wanted to or not, he found himself returning to the tree again. Not only was there nothing else to move toward, but the world itself seemed somehow curved, so that no matter which direction he took, eventually he found himself heading back toward the monumental trunk. He sat with his back against it for a while and tried to sleep. Sleep would not come, but stubbornly he kept his eyes closed anyway. He was not happy with the puzzle set before him. He had been struck by an exploding shell. The war and everyone in it seemed to have vanished, although a conflict of that size should have been a rather difficult thing to misplace. The light had not changed in this place since he had come here, although it must have been hours since the explosion, and the only other thing in the world was an immense, impossible vegetable. He prayed that when he opened his eyes again he would either find himself in some sort of respectable afterlife, or returned to the familiar misery of the trenches with Mullet and Finch and the rest of the platoon. When the prayer had ended, he still did not risk a look, determined to give God, or whoever, enough time to put things right. He sat, doing his best to ignore the band of pain across the back of his head, letting the silence seep into him as he waited for normality to reassert itself. At last, he opened his eyes. Mist, mud, and that immense, damnable tree. Nothing had changed. Paul sighed deeply and stood up. He did not remember much about his life before the war, and at this moment even the immediate past was dim. But he did remember that there had been a certain kind of story in which an impossible thing happened, and once that impossible thing had proved that it was not going to unhappen again, there was only one course of action left. The impossible thing must be treated as a possible thing. What did you do with an unavoidable tree that grew up into the sky beyond the clouds? You climbed it. It was not as difficult as he had expected. Although no branches jutted from the trunk until just below the belly of the clouds, the very size of the tree helped him. The bark was pitted and cracked like the skin of some immense serpent, providing excellent toeholds and handholds. Some of the bumps were big enough to sit on, allowing him to catch his breath in relative safety and comfort. But still, it was not easy. Although it was hard to tell in that timeless, sunless place, he felt he had been climbing for at least half a day when he reached the first branch. It was as broad as a country road, bending up and away. Where it, too, vanished into the clouds, he could see the first faint shapes of leaves. Paul lay down where the branch met the trunk and tried to sleep. But though he was very tired, sleep still would not come. When he had rested for a while, he got up and resumed climbing. After a while, the air grew cooler, and he began to feel the wet touch of clouds. The sky around the great tree was becoming murkier, the ends of the branches obscured. He could see vast, shadowy shapes hanging in the distant foliage overhead, but could not identify them. Another half-hour's climbing revealed them to be monstrous apples, each as large as a barrage balloon. As he mounted higher, the fog thickened until he was surrounded by a phantom world of branches and drifting, tattered clouds, as though he clambered in the rigging of a ghost ship. No sound reached him but the creaking and scratching of bark beneath his feet. Breezes blew, cooling the thin sweat on his forehead, but none of them blew hard enough to shake the great flat leaves. Silence and shreds of mist. The great trunk and its mantle of branches above and below him, a world in itself. Paul climbed on. The clouds began to grow even more dense, and he could sense the light changing. Something warm was making the mists glow, like a lantern behind thick curtains. He rested again, and wondered how long it would take him to fall if he were to step off the branch on which he sat. He plucked a loose button from his shirt cuff and let it drop, watching it shiver down the air currents until it vanished silently into the clouds below. Later, he had no idea how much later, he found himself climbing into growing radiance. The gray bark began to show traces of other colors, sandy beiges and pale yellows. The upper surfaces of the branches seemed flattened by the new, harsher light, and the surrounding mist gleamed and sparkled as though tiny rainbows played between the individual drops. The cloud mist was so thick here that it impeded his climb, curling around his face in dripping tendrils, lubricating his grip, weighting his clothes, and dragging at him treacherously as he negotiated difficult hand-to-hand changeovers. He briefly considered giving up, but there was nowhere else for him to go except back down. It seemed worth risking an unpleasantly swift descent to avoid the slower alternative, which could lead only to eternal nothingness on that gray plain. In any case, Paul thought, if he was already dead, he couldn't die again. If he was alive, then he was part of a fairy tale, and surely no one ever died this early in the story. The clouds grew thicker. The last 100 yards of his ascent, he might have been climbing through rotting muslin. The damp resistance kept him from noticing how bright the world was becoming. But as he pushed through the last clouds and lifted his head, blinking, it was to find himself beneath a dazzling, brassy sun and a sky of pure, unclouded blue. No clouds above, but clouds everywhere else. The top of the great frothy mass through which he had just climbed stretched away before him like a white meadow, a miles-wide, hummocked plain of cloud stuff, and in the distance, shimmering in the brilliant sunlight, a castle. As Paul stared, the pale, slender towers seemed to stretch and waver, like something seen through the waters of a mountain lake. Still, it was clearly a castle, not just an illusion compounded of clouds and sun. Colorful pennants danced from the tops of the sharp turrets, and the huge portcullis gate was a grinning mouth opening onto darkness. He laughed, suddenly and abruptly, but his eyes filled with tears. It was beautiful. It was terrifying. After the great gray emptiness and the half-world of the clouds, it was too bright, too strong, almost too real. Still, it was what he had been climbing toward. It called to him as clearly as if it had possessed a voice. just as the dim awareness of an inescapable something awaiting him had summoned him to climb the tree. There was the faintest suggestion of a path across the spun sugar plain, a more solid line of whiteness that stretched from the tree and meandered away toward the distant castle gate. He climbed until his feet were level with the top of the clouds, paused for a moment to revel in the strong, swift beating of his heart, then stepped off the branch. For a sickening instant the whiteness gave, but only a little. He windmilled his arms for balance, then discovered that it was no worse than standing on a mattress. He began to walk. The castle grew larger as he approached. If Paul had retained any doubts that he was in a story, and not a real place, the ever-clearer view of his destination would have dispelled them. It was clearly something that someone had made up. It was real, of course, and quite solid, although what did that mean to a man walking across the clouds? But it was real in the way of things long believed in but never seen. It had the shape of a castle. It was as much a castle as something could ever be, but it was no more a medieval fortress than it was a chair or a glass of beer. It was an idea of a castle, Paul realized, a sort of platonic ideal unrelated to the grubby realities of Mott and Bailey architecture or feudal warfare. Platonic ideal? He had no idea where that had come from. Memories were swimming just below the surface of his conscious mind, closer than ever, but still as strangely unfocused as the many-towered vision before him. He walked on beneath the unmoving sun, wisps of cloud rising from his heels like smoke. The gate was open, but did not seem welcoming. For all the diffuse glimmer of the towers, the entranceway itself was deep, black, and empty. Paul stood before the looming hole for some time, his blood lively in his veins, his self-protective reflexes urging him to turn back, even though he knew he must enter. At last, feeling even more naked than he had beneath the hail of shellfire which had begun the whole mad dream, he took a breath and stepped through. The vast stone chamber beyond the door was curiously stark, the only decoration a single great banner, red embroidered with black and gold, that hung on the far wall. It bore a vase or chalice, out of which grew two twining roses, with a crown floating above the flowers. Below the picture was the legend Ad Aeternum. As he stepped forward to examine it, his footsteps reverberated through the empty chamber, so loud after the muffling cloud carpet that it startled him. He thought that someone would surely come to see who had entered, but the doors at either end of the chamber remained shut, and no other sound joined the dying echoes. It was hard to stare at the banner for long. Each individual thread of black and gold seemed to move, so that the whole picture swam blurrily before his eyes. It was only when he stepped back almost to the entrance that he could see the picture clearly again, but it still told him nothing of this place or who might live here. Paul looked at the doors at either end. There seemed little to choose between them, so he turned toward the one on the left. Though it seemed only a score or so of paces away, it took him a surprisingly long time to reach it. Paul looked back. The far portal was now only a dark spot a great distance away, and the antechamber itself seemed to be filling with mist, as though clouds were beginning to drift in from outside. He turned and found that the door he had sought now loomed before him. It swung open easily at his touch, so he stepped through, and found himself in a jungle. But it was not quite that, he realized a moment later. Vegetation grew thickly everywhere, but he could see shadowy walls through the looping vines and long leaves. Arched windows set high on those walls looked out on a sky busy with dark storm clouds, quite a different sky than the shield of pure blue he had left beyond the front gate. The jungle was everywhere, but he was still inside, even though the outside was not his own. This chamber was larger even than the huge front hall. Far, far above the nodding, poisonous-looking flowers and the riot of greenery stretched a ceiling covered with intricate, sharp-angled patterns, all of gleaming gold, like a jeweled map of a labyrinth. Another memory came drifting up, the smell and the warm, wet air tickling it free. This kind of place was called a conservatory, a place where things were kept, he dimly recalled, where things grew, where secrets were hidden. He stepped forward, pushing the sticky fronds of a long-leafed plant out of his path, then had to do a sudden dance to avoid tumbling into a pond that the plant had hidden. Dozens of tiny fish, red as pennies heated in a forge, darted away in alarm. He turned and moved along the edge of the pond, searching for a path. The plants were dusty. As he worked his way through the thickest tangles, powdery clouds rose up into the light, angling down through the high windows, swirling bits of floating silver and mica. He paused, waiting for the dust to settle. In the silence, a low sound drifted to him. Someone was weeping. He reached up with both hands and spread the leaves as though they were curtains. Framed in the twining vegetation stood a great bell-shaped cage, its slender golden bars so thickly wound with flowering vines it was hard to see what it contained. He moved closer, and something inside the cage moved. Paul stopped short. It was a woman. It was a bird. It was a woman. She turned, her wide black eyes wet. A great cloud of dark hair framed her long face and spilled down her back to merge with the purple and iridescent green of her strange costume. But it was no costume. She was clothed in feathers. Beneath her arms, long pinions lay folded like a paper fan. Wings. "Who's there?" she cried. It was all a dream, of course. Perhaps just the last hallucinatory moments of a battlefield casualty. But as her voice crept into him and settled itself like something that had found its home, he knew that he would never forget the sound of it. There was determination and sorrow, and the edge of madness, all in those two words. He stepped forward. Her great round eyes went wider still.
"Who are you? You do not belong here."
Paul stared at her, although he could not help feeling that he was doing her some insult, as though her feathered limbs were a sort of deformity. Perhaps they were. Or perhaps in this strange place he was the deformed one.
"Are you a ghost?"
she asked.
"If so, I waste my breath. But you do not look like a ghost."
"I don't know what I am." Paul's dry mouth made it hard to speak. "I don't know where I am either, but I don't feel like a ghost."
"You can talk."
Her alarm was such that Paul feared he had done something dreadful.
"You do not belong here."
"Why are you crying? Can I help you?"
"You must go away. You must. The old man will be back soon."
Her agitated movements filled the room with a soft rustling. More dust fluttered into the air. "Who is this old man? And who are you?" She moved to the edge of the cage, grasping the bars in her slender fingers.
"Go! Go now!"
But her gaze was greedy, as though she wished to make him into a memory that would not fade.
"You are hurt. There is blood on your clothing."
Paul looked down. "Old blood? Who are you?" She shook her head.
"No one."
She paused, and her face moved as though she would say something shocking or dangerous, but the moment passed.
"I am no one. You must go before the old man returns."
"But what is this place? Where am I?" "All I have are questions and more questions."
"You should not be here. Only ghosts visit me here, and the old man's evil instruments. He says they are to keep me company, but some of them have teeth and very unusual senses of humor. Butterball and nickel plate. They are the cruelest."
Overwhelmed, Paul suddenly stepped forward and grasped her hand where it curled around the bars. Her skin was cool, and her face was very close. "You are a prisoner. I will free you." She jerked her hand away.
"I cannot survive outside this cage, and you cannot survive if the old man finds you here. Have you come hunting the Grail? You will not find it here. This is only a shadow place."
Paul shook his head impatiently. "I know nothing of any Grail." But even as he spoke, he knew it was not the full truth. The words set up an echo deep inside him, touched parts that were still out of his reach. Grail. Something. It meant something.
"You do not understand,"
the bird woman said, and shining feathers ruffled and bunched around her neck as she grew angry.
"I am not one of the guardians. I have nothing to hide from you, and I would not see you. I would not see you harmed. Go, you fool! Even if you could take it, the old man would find you no matter where you went. He would hunt you down even if you crossed the wide ocean."
Paul could feel the fear beating out from her, and for a moment he was overwhelmed, unable to speak or move. She was afraid for him. This prisoned angel felt something for him, and the Grail, whatever it might be, he could feel the idea of it swimming just beyond his grasp like one of the bright fish. A terrible hissing sound, loud as a thousand serpents, set the leaves around them swaying. The bird woman gasped and shrank back into the center of her cage. A moment later, a great clanging tread sounded through the trees, which shivered, stirring more dust.
"It's him!"
Her voice was a muffled shriek.
"He's back!"
Something huge was coming nearer. puffing and banging like a war engine. A harsh light flickered through the trees.
Hide!
The naked terror in her whisper set his heart hammering.
He will suck the marrow from your bones!
The noise was becoming louder. The walls themselves were quivering, the ground pitching. Paul took a step, then stumbled and sank to his knees as terror fell on him like a black wave. He crawled into the thickest part of the undergrowth, leaves slapping against his face, smearing him with dust and damp. A loud creak sounded, as of mighty hinges. Then the room was filled with the smell of an electrical storm. Paul covered his eyes.
I am home!
The old man's voice was loud as cannon fire, and just as boomingly inhuman.
And where is your song to greet me?
The long silence was broken only by that hiss like escaping steam. At last the bird woman spoke, faint and tremulous.
I did not expect you back so soon. I was not prepared.
And what do you have to do besides prepare for my return?
More crashing footsteps sounded as the old man moved nearer.
You seem distracted, my nightingale. Has Butterball been playing roughly with you?
No, I do not feel well today.
I am not surprised. There is a foul smell about the place.
The ozone stench grew stronger, and through his laced fingers, Paul could see the light flickering again.
As a matter of fact, it smells like a man.
How could that be?
Why do you not look me in the eye, little songbird? Something is amiss here.
The steps grew closer. The floor shuddered, and Paul could hear a discordant creaking like a bridge in high wind.
I believe there is a man here. I believe you have had a visitor.
Run!
The bird woman screamed. Paul cursed and staggered to his feet, surrounded by head-high branches. A vast shadow hung over the room, blocking the soft gray light from the windows, replacing them with the stark blue-white of its own nimbus of sparks. Paul flung himself forward, smashing through the clinging leaves, his heart beating like a greyhound's. The door. If he could only find the door again.
Something scurrying in the shrubbery.
The Titan's voice was amused.
Warm flesh, and wet blood, and crisp little bones.
Paul splashed through the pond and almost lost his balance. He could see the door, only a few yards away. But the great clanking thing was just behind him.
Run!
The woman pleaded. Even in his terror, he knew that she would suffer some dreadful punishment for this. He felt that he had somehow betrayed her. He reached the door and flung himself through, skidding and then rolling on the smooth stone floor. The huge gate stood before him, and thank God it was open. 100 steps, maybe more, difficult as running in treacle. The whole castle shook beneath his pursuer's tread. He reached the door and flung himself through and out into what had been sunlight, but was now twilight gray. The topmost branches of the great trees stood just above the edge of the clouds, a seemingly impossible distance away. Paul bolted toward it across the field of clouds. The thing was pushing through the door. He heard the great hinges squeal as it forced its way. Lightning-scented air billowed past him, almost knocking him off his feet, and a great roar filled the sky. The old man was laughing.
Come back, little creature. I want to play with you.
Paul sprinted across the cloud trail, his breath scorching in his lungs. The tree was a little closer now. How fast would he have to climb down to move beyond the reach of that terrible thing? Surely it couldn't follow him. How could even the great tree bear the weight of such a monstrosity? The clouds below his feet stretched and jounced like a trampoline as the old man stepped from the castle. Paul tripped and fell forward. One of his hands came down to the side of the trail, pushing through the cloud surface as through cobwebs. He scrambled to his feet and sped forward again. The tree was only a few 100 paces away now. If he could only... A great gray hand as big as a steam shovel curled around him, a thing of cables and rivets and rusting sheet iron. Paul screamed. The clouds fell away as he was jerked high into the air, then turned to dangle in front of the old man's face. Paul screamed again, and heard another cry, dim but mournful, echo from the distant castle, the keening of a caged bird. The old man's eyes were the vast, cracked faces of tower clocks, his beard a welter of curling, rusted wire. He was impossibly huge, a giant of iron and battered copper pipes, and slowly turning wheels that steamed at every crack, every vent. He stank of electricity, and grinned a row of concrete tombstones.
"Guests may not leave before I can entertain them."
Paul felt the bones of his skull vibrate from the power of the old man's voice. As the great maw opened wider, Paul kicked and struggled in the cloud of choking steam.
"Too small to make much of a meal, really,"
said the old man, then swallowed him. Shrieking, Paul fell down into oily, gear-grinding darkness.
"Quit that, you bloody idiot!"
Paul struggled, but someone or something was holding his arms. He shuddered and went limp.
"That's better. Here, have a little of this."
Something trickled into his mouth and burned down his throat.
He coughed explosively and struggled to sit up.
This time he was allowed to. Someone laughed. He opened his eyes. Finch was sitting beside him, almost on top of him, framed by the mud of the trench top and a sliver of sky.
"You'll be all right."
Finch put the cap back on the flask and stowed it in his pocket.
"Just a bit of a knock on the head. Sad to say, it's not enough to get you home, old man. Still, Mullet will be pleased to see you when he gets back from shifting his bowels. I told him you'd be fine."
Paul leaned back, his head full of muddled thoughts.
"Where?" "In one of the back trenches. I think I dug this bastard myself 2 years ago. Fritz suddenly decided the war wasn't over yet. We've been pushed quite a way back. Don't you remember?"
Paul struggled to hold on to the diminishing tatters of his dream. A woman with feathers like a bird, who spoke of a grail, a giant like a railroad engine, made of metal and hot steam. And what happened? To me. Finch reached behind him and produced Paul's helmet. One side of the crown was dimpled inward.
"Piece of shrapnel, but not enough to get you shipped back. Not very lucky, are you, Jonesy?"
So it had all been a dream. Just a hallucination after a minor head wound. Paul looked at Finch's familiar face, his gray-shot mustache, the weary eyes behind steel-rimmed spectacles, and knew that he was back where he was supposed to be, sunk once more in the mud and the blood. Of course, the war went on, uncaring of the dreams of soldiers, a reality so devastating that no other reality could compete. Paul's head ached. He reached up to rub his temple with a dirty hand, and as he did so, something fluttered from his sleeve into his lap. He looked quickly at Finch, but the other man was rooting in his bag, hunting a tin of bully beef, and had not seen. He lifted the object and let it catch the last rays of the sun. The green feather sparkled, impossibly real, impossibly bright, and completely untouched by mud. First, universe next door. Pity this busy monster, man unkind, not. Progress is a comfortable disease. Your victim, death and life safely beyond, plays with the bigness of his littleness. Electrons deify one razor blade into a mountain range. Lenses extend unwish through curving where-when till unwish returns on its unself. A world of made is not a world of born. Pity poor flesh and trees, poor stars and stones, but never this fine specimen of hyper-magical ultra-omnipotence. We doctors know a hopeless case if...
Listen, there's a hell of a good universe next door. Let's go.
E.E. Cummings. Chapter 1. Mr. Jingo's Smile. Netfeed News. Failed chip leads to murder spree. Visual, Kashivili at arraignment in body restraints. V.O. Convict Alexander Kashivili's behavioral chip suffered an unexpected failure, authorities said today, after the mod paroled Kashivili. Visual, scorched shopfront. Parked fire trucks and ambulances. Killed 17 restaurant customers in a flamethrower attack in the Sierpukhov area of Greater Moscow. Visual, Dr. Konstantin Gruhoff in university office. Gruhoff, the technology is still in its early stages. There will be accidents. One of the other instructors pushed open the cubicle door and leaned in. The noise of the corridor swept in with him, louder than usual.
Bomb threat.
Again?
Rini set her pad down on the desk and picked up her bag. Remembering how many things had gone missing during the last scare, she retrieved the pad before walking into the hallway. The man who had told her, she could never remember his name, Yono something or other, was several paces ahead, vanishing into the river of students and instructors moving leisurely toward the exits. She hurried to catch him. "Every 2 weeks," she said, "once a day during exams. It makes me crazy." He smiled. He had thick glasses, but nice teeth. "At least we will get some fresh air." Within minutes, the wide street in front of Durban Area 4 Polytechnic had become a sort of impromptu carnival, full of laughing students glad to be out of class. One group of young men had tied their coats around their waists like skirts and were dancing atop a parked car, ignoring an older teacher's increasingly shrill orders to cease and desist. Rini watched them with mixed feelings. She, too, could feel the lure of freedom, just as she felt the warm African sun on her arms and neck. But she also knew that she was 3 days behind grading term projects. If the bomb scare went on too long, she would miss a tutorial that would have to be rescheduled, eating up more of her rapidly dwindling spare time. Yono, or whatever his name was, grinned at the dancing students. Rini felt a surge of annoyance at his irresponsible enjoyment.
"If they want to miss class," she said, "why the hell don't they just skip out? Why play a prank like this and make the rest of us—"
A flash of brilliant light turned the sky white. Rini was knocked to the ground by a brief hurricane of hot, dry air as a tremendous clap of sound shattered glass all along the school facade and shivered the windows of dozens of parked cars. She covered her head with her arms, but there was no debris, only the sound of people screaming. When she struggled to her feet, she could see no sign of injuries on the students milling around her, but a cloud of black smoke was boiling above what must be the admin building in the middle of the campus. The campanile was gone, a blackened, smoking stump of fibramic skeleton all that remained of the colorful tower. She let out her breath, suddenly nauseated and lightheaded.
"Jesus mercy!"
Her colleague clambered to his feet beside her, his dark skin now almost gray.
"A real one this time. God, I hope they got everyone out. They probably did. Admin always clears first so they can monitor the evacuation."
He was speaking so rapidly she could hardly understand him.
"Who do you think it was?"
Rini shook her head.
"Broderbund? Zulu Mamba? Who knows? God damn it! That's the third in 2 years. How can they do it? Why won't they let us work?"
Her companion's look of alarm deepened.
"My car! It's in the admin lot!"
He turned and ran toward the explosion site, pushing his way through lost-looking students, some of whom were crying, none of whom seemed in any mood for laughing or dancing now. A security guard who was trying to cordon off the area shouted at him as he ran past.
"His car? Idiot!"
Rini felt like crying herself. There was a distant ululation of sirens. She took a cigarette out of her bag and pulled the flame tab with trembling fingers. They were supposed to be non-carcinogenic, but right at the moment she didn't care. A piece of paper fluttered down and landed at her feet, blackened along its edges. Already the camera drones were descending from the sky like a swarm of flies, sucking up footage for the net. She was on her second cigarette and feeling a little steadier when someone tapped her shoulder. "Ms. Sulawayo?" She turned and found herself confronting a slender boy with yellow-brown skin. His short hair curled close to his head. He wore a necktie, something Rini had not seen in a few years.
"Yes?"
"I believe we had an appointment. A tutorial?"
She stared. The top of his head barely reached her shoulder.
You're...
"Habu!"
There was a clicking sound in it, as though he had cracked a knuckle.
"With an X, and an exclamation point when the name is written in English letters."
Light suddenly dawned.
"Ah, you're..."
He smiled, a swift crease of white.
"One of the San people, what they sometimes call Bushmen."
"Yes."
"I didn't mean to be rude."
"You are not. There are few of us left who have the pure blood, the old look. Most have married into the city world, or died in the bush, unable to live in these times."
She liked his grin and his quick, careful speech.
"But you have done neither."
"No, I have not. I am a university student."
He said it with some pride, but a hint of self-mockery as well. He turned to look at the drifting plume of smoke.
"If there will be a university left..."
She shook her head and suppressed a shudder. The sky, stained with drifting ash, had gone twilight gray.
"It's so terrible."
"Terrible indeed, but fortunately no one seems badly hurt."
"Well, I'm sorry our tutorial was prevented,"
she said, recovering a little bit of her professional edge.
I suppose we should reschedule. Let me get out my pad. Must we reschedule? Khabu asked. I am not doing anything. It seems that we will not get back into the university for some time. Perhaps we could go to another place. Perhaps somewhere that sells beer, since my throat is dry from smoke, and do our talking there. Rini hesitated. Should she just leave the campus? What if her department head or someone needed her? She looked around at the street and the main steps, which were beginning to resemble a combination refugee center and free festival, and shrugged. Nothing useful would be done here today. Let's go find a beer, then. The train to Pinetown was not running. Someone had jumped or been pushed onto the tracks at Durban Outskirt. Rini's legs were aching, and her damp shirt was stuck to her body when she finally reached the flat block. The elevator wasn't running either, but that was nothing new. She trudged up the stairs and dumped her bag on the table in front of the mirror and stopped, arrested by her reflection. Just yesterday, a colleague at work had criticized her short, practical haircut, saying that a woman as tall as Rini should try to look more feminine. She scowled and examined the dust streaked down her long white shirt. When did she have time to make herself pretty? And who cared, anyway? I'm home, she called. No one answered. She poked her head around the corner and saw her younger brother Stephen in his chair, as expected. Stephen was faceless behind his net headset, and he held a squeezer in each hand as he tilted from side to side. Rini wondered what he was experiencing, then decided it might be better if she didn't know. The kitchen was empty, nothing in sight that looked like a hot meal being prepared. She cursed quietly, hoping it was just because her father had fallen asleep.
"Who's there? Is that you, girl?"
She cursed again, anger rising. It was clear from his slurred tone that her father had found something besides cooking to while away his afternoon.
"Yes, it's me."
After a rattling thump and a sound like a large piece of furniture being dragged across the floor, his tall shape appeared in the bedroom doorway, swaying slightly.
"How come you so late?"
"Because the train's not running, and because someone blew up half the university today."
Her father considered this for a moment.
"Broderbund. Those Afrikaner bastards, for sure."
Long Joseph Sulueo was a firm believer in the indelible evil of all white South Africans.
"Nobody knows yet. It could have been anyone."
"You arguing with me?"
Long Joseph tried to fix her with a baleful stare, his eyes red and watering. He was like an old bull, she thought, enfeebled but still dangerous. It tired her out just looking at him.
"No, I'm not arguing with you. I thought you were going to make dinner for once."
"Walter come by. We had a lot of talking to do."
"Had a lot of drinking to do,"
she thought, but held her tongue. Angry as she was, it wasn't worth going through another evening of shouting and broken crockery.
"So it's up to me again, is it?"
He swayed again, then turned back into the darkness of his bedroom.
"Suit yourself. I'm not hungry. I need some rest. A man needs his sleep."
The bedsprings rasped. Then there was silence. Rini waited a moment, clenching and unclenching her fists, then stalked over and pulled the bedroom door closed, trying to make herself some room, some free space. She looked over at Stephen, still rocking and jiggling in the net. He might as well be catatonic. She slumped into a chair and lit another cigarette. It was important to remember her father as he had been, she reminded herself, as he still occasionally was. A proud man, a kind man. There were some people in whom weakness, once it had appeared, grew like a cancer. Mama's death in the department store fire had found and revealed that weakness. Joseph Sulueo no longer seemed to have the strength to fight back against life. He was letting it all go, slowly but surely disconnecting from the world, its pains and disappointments.
"A man needs his sleep,"
Rini thought, and for the second time that day, she shuddered. She bent down and tapped the interrupt button. Still faceless in his headset, Stephen spasmed in indignation. When he did not lift the insectoid visor, Rini held the button down.
"What for?"
Stephen was already demanding before he had finished pulling the headset free.
"Me and Silky and Eddie were almost to the inner district gateway. We've never gotten that far before."
"Because I made you dinner, and I want you to eat it before it gets cold."
"I'll wave it when I'm done."
"No, you won't. Come on, Stephen. There was a bomb at school today. It was frightening. I'd like to have your company over dinner."
He straightened, the appeal to his vanity effective.
"Chiz, what'd you make?"
"Chicken and rice.
He made a face, but was seated and pushing it into his mouth before she returned from the kitchen with a glass of beer for herself and a soft drink for him.
What blew up?
He chewed rapidly.
People killed?
No one, thank God. She tried not to be disheartened by his clear look of disappointment, but it destroyed the Campanile. You remember, the tower in the middle of the campus.
Chiz Major! Who did it? Zulu Mamba?
No one knows, but it frightened me.
A bomb went off in my school last week.
What? You never said a word about that.
He grimaced in disgust, then wiped grease from his chin.
Not that kind. In Schoolnet. Sabotage. Someone said that some guys from upper form did it as a graduation prank.
You're talking about a system crash on the net. She wondered for a moment if Stephen understood the difference between the net and real life.
He's only 11,
she reminded herself.
Things outside of his narrow circle aren't very real yet. The bomb that went off at the Poly today could have killed hundreds of people, killed them dead.
I know, but the blowdown on Schoolnet killed a lot of crafts, and even some high-level constellations, backups and all. They'll never come back again either.
He reached out for the rice dish, ready for seconds. Weenie sighed.
Crafts. Constellations. If she were not a net-literate instructor herself, she would probably think her brother was speaking a foreign language.
Tell me what else you've been doing. Have you read any of that book I gave you? For his birthday, she had downloaded, at not inconsiderable cost, Othulu's Marching Toward Freedom, the best and most stirring work she knew on South Africa's fight for democracy in the late 20th century. As a concession to her young brother's tastes, she had purchased the expensive interactive version, full of historical video footage and stylish You Are There 3D reenactments.
Not yet. I looked at it. Politics.
It's more than that, Stephen. It's your heritage. It's our history.
He chewed. Soki and Eddie and me almost made it into the inner district. We got this flow passed off a guy in upper form. We were almost downtown. Open ticket.
Stephen, I don't want you trying to get to the inner district.
You used to do it when you were my age.
His grin was insolently disarming.
Things were different then. You can get arrested these days. Big fines. I'm serious, boy. Don't do it.
But she knew the warning was useless. Might as well tell children not to swim in the old fishing hole. Stephen was already nattering on as though she hadn't said anything. She sighed. From the level of excitement, she knew she was in for a 40-minute discourse, full of obscure junior netboy argot.
It was Chiz Major sampled. We dodged 3 bully boxes. But we weren't doing anything wrong,
he said hurriedly.
Just tapping and napping. But it was so flared. We met someone who got into Mr. J's.
Mr. J's? This was the first thing she hadn't recognized. Stephen's look suddenly changed. Weenie thought she saw something flicker behind his eyes.
Oh, just this place. Kind of like a club.
What kind of a club? An entertainment place? Shows and stuff?
Yeah, shows and stuff.
He toyed with his chicken bone for a moment.
It's just a place.
Something thumped on the wall.
Weenie, bring me a glass of water.
Long Joseph's voice sounded groggy and stupid. Weenie winced, but went to the sink. For now, Stephen deserved something like a normal home life. But when he was finally out on his own, things would change around here. When she got back, Stephen was finishing his third helping. But she could tell by his jittering leg and half-out-of-the-seat posture that he was aching to get back to the net. Not so fast, young warrior. We've barely had a chance to talk. Now something almost like panic flashed across his face, and Reenie felt her stomach go sour. He was definitely spending too much recreation time plugged in if he was so desperate to get back. She would make sure he spent some time out of the house. If she took him to the park this Saturday, she could make sure he didn't just go over to a friend's, plug in, and spend the whole day lying on the floor like an invertebrate.
"So tell me more about the bomb," Stephen said suddenly. "Tell me all about it."
She did. And he listened carefully and asked questions. He seemed so interested that she also told him about her first meeting with her student, Khabu, how small and polite he was, his odd, old-fashioned style of dress.
"There was a boy like him in my school last year,"
Stephen said,
"but he got sick and had to leave."
Weenie thought of Khabu as he had waved goodbye, his slender arm and sweet, almost sad face. Would he, too, get sick somehow, physically or spiritually? He had said that few of his people did well living in the city. She hoped he would prove an exception. She had liked his quiet sense of humor. Stephen got up and cleared away the dishes, without being asked. then plugged in again, but surprisingly accessed marching toward freedom, disengaging from time to time to ask her questions about it. After he finally went to his room, Renee read term papers for another hour and a half, then accessed the news bank. She watched reports about a variety of faraway problems. A new strain of the Bukavu virus forcing quarantines in Central Africa, a tsunami in the Philippines, UN sanctions on the Red Sea Free State, and a class-action suit against a childcare service in Joburg, and the local news as well, including lots of footage about the bomb at the college. It was strange to be on the net, watching in 360-degree stereoscope the same thing she had seen with her own eyes that morning. It was hard to tell which experience was more convincingly real, and these days, what did real mean anyway? The headset began to feel claustrophobic, so she pulled it off and watched the rest of the news she wanted to see on the wall screen. Full surround was a bit of a busman's holiday for her anyway. It was only after she had made everyone's lunch for the next day, then set her alarm and climbed into her own bed, that the feeling which had nagged her all evening finally surfaced. Stephen had manipulated her somehow. They had been talking about something, and he had changed the subject. Then they had never got back to it. His subsequent behavior alone had been suspicious enough to suggest that he was avoiding something. She couldn't for the life of her remember what they had been discussing. Some netboy larking, probably. She made a mental note to speak to him about it. But there was so much to do, so very much to do, and never enough hours in the day. "That's what I need." She was bleary with approaching sleep. Even her thoughts felt heavy, like a burden she ached to put down. "I don't need more net, more full-surround realism, more pictures and sounds. I just need more time."
"Now I have seen it."
Habu contemplated the apparently distant white walls of the simulation.
"But I still do not understand precisely. You say this is not a real place?"
She turned to face him. Even though she herself was only vaguely human in appearance, beginners were comforted by retaining as many of the forms of normal interaction as possible. Habu, in this beginner's simulation, was a gray human-shaped figure with a red X across his chest. Even though the X was a normal part of the simuloid, Renee had inscribed a complimentary scarlet R across her own figure. Again, anything to make the transition easier.
"I don't mean to be rude," she said carefully, "but I'm really not used to having this kind of session with an adult. Please don't be offended if I tell you something that seems very obvious."
Habu's simuloid had no face, hence no facial expression, but his voice was light.
"I am not easy to offend, and I know I am an odd case, but there is no net access in the Okavango swamps. Please teach me what you would teach a child."
Again, Renee wondered what Habu wasn't telling her. It had become clear in the past few weeks that he had some kind of weird connections. No one else would be jumped into the Polytechnic's advanced networker program without any background. It was like sending someone to a Johannesburg University literature course to learn their ABCs. But he was smart, very smart. With his small stature and formal manner, it was tempting to think of him as a child or some kind of idiot savant.
"Then again," she thought, "how long would I survive naked and unarmed in the Kalahari? Not bloody long."
There was still more to living in the world than net skills.
"Okay, you know the basics about computers and information processing. Now, when you say, 'Is this a real place?' you're asking a very difficult question. An apple is a real thing, yes? But a picture of an apple is not an apple. It looks like an apple. It makes you think about apples. You can even choose one pictured apple over another in terms of which might taste better. But you can't taste either of them. You can't eat a picture, or at least it isn't like eating a real apple. It's only a symbol, no matter how realistic-looking, for a real thing. Got that?"
Habu laughed. "I understand you so far."
"Well, the difference between an imagined something, a concept, and a real thing used to be fairly straightforward. Even the most realistic picture of a house was only an image. You could imagine what it would be like to go inside, but you couldn't actually go inside it. That's because it didn't fully replicate the experience of going into a real house, with all that entails. But what if you could make something that felt like a real thing, tasted like it, smelled like it, but wasn't that thing, wasn't a thing at all, but only a symbol of a thing, like a picture?
There are places," in the Kalahari Desert, Khabu said slowly, where you see water, a pool of sweet water, but when you go to it, it is gone, a mirage. Rini waved her hand, and a pool of water appeared at the far side of the simulation. A mirage, Khabu agreed. He seemed to be ignoring her illustration. But if you could touch it, and it was wet, if you could drink it and quench your thirst, then would it not be water? It is hard to imagine something that is real and not real. Weenie led him across the bare white floor of the simulation to the pool she had conjured. Look at this. See the reflections? Now watch me. She knelt and scooped water with her simuloid hands. It ran out between her fingers, drizzling into the pool. Circular ripples crossed and recrossed each other. This is a very basic setup. That is, your interface equipment, the goggles and sensors you just put on, are not very advanced. But even with what we have, this looks like water, does it not? Moves like water? Khabu bent and ran his gray fingers through the pool. It flows a little strangely. Rini waved her hand. Money and time make it more realistic. There are external simulation rigs so well made that not only would this move just like real water, but you would feel it, cold and wet on your skin. And then there are CANs, neurocannular implants, which you and I won't get to use unless we wind up working for the top government labs. They let you pour computer-simulated sensations directly into your nervous system. If you had one of those, you could drink this water, and it would feel and taste just like the real thing. But it would not quench my thirst, would it? If I did not drink real water, I would die. He didn't sound worried, just interested. You would indeed. It's a good thing to remember.
End of Side 1. To continue, turn the cassette over. Side 2. City of Golden Shadow. Otherland, Volume 1. By Tad Williams. Continuing on page 31.
A decade or two ago, you used to hear about a net boy or a net girl dying every couple of weeks. Too long under simulation. Forgot they needed real food and real water. Not to mention ordinary things like pressure sores. Doesn't happen much anymore. Too many safeguards on the commercial products. Too many restrictions and alarm routines on net access at universities and in business. Rini waved her hand, and the water disappeared. She waved again, and a forest of evergreen trees suddenly filled the empty space around them. Reddish rippled bark rising in tall columns, and a blur of dark leafy greenness high above. Khabu's sudden intake of breath gave her a childish satisfaction. "It's all down to input and output," she said. Just as someone used to sit in front of a flat screen and punch in instructions on a keyboard, now we wave our hands in a certain way and do magic. But it's not magic. It's just input, just telling the processing part of the machinery what to do. And instead of the result appearing on a screen in front of us, we receive the output as stereoscopic visuals. She indicated the trees. Sound. She gestured again. A whisper of birdsong filled the forest. And whatever else you want. Limited only by the sophistication of your processing machinery and your interface equipment.
Weenie tweaked up a few details, placing a sun in the sky above the filigree of branches, carpeting the forest floor in grass and small white flowers. When she had finished, she spread her hands in a little flourish.
See? You don't even have to do all the work. The machines tidy up the details. Angles and length of shadows, all that. This stuff is easy. You've already learned the basics. You'll be doing this yourself in a matter of weeks.
The first time I watched my grandfather make a fishing spear, Khabu said slowly, I thought that was magic, too. His fingers moved so fast that I couldn't see what they did. Chip here, turn there, twist the cord. Then suddenly there it was.
Exactly. The only difference is that if you want to make the best fishing spears in this environment, you have to find someone who will pay for it. VR equipment starts with the simple stuff everyone has at home. Everyone outside the Okavango swamps, that is.
She wished he could see she was smiling. She hadn't meant the remark to be offensive.
But to get to the top of the line, you have to own a diamond mine or two, or a small country. But even at a backwater college like this, with our creaky old equipment, I can show you many things.
You have showed me many things already, Ms. Sulawayo. May we make something else now? Might I make something?
Creating in VR environments.
She paused, trying to decide how to explain.
I can show you how to do things. Make things. But you wouldn't really be doing the work. Not at this level. You'd just be telling some very sophisticated programs what you wanted, and they'd give it to you. That's fine, but you should learn the basics first. It would be as if your grandfather did all but the last stroke of work on the spear and gave you that to do. You wouldn't have made it, and you wouldn't really have learned how to make one of your own.
So you are saying that first I need to hunt the right kind of wood, learn how to see and shape the spearhead, how to decide where to put the first chip.
He spread his simuloid arms in a comical way.
Yes?
She laughed.
Yes. But as long as you realize there's a lot less dramatic work to be done before any of this is useful, I'll show you how to make something.
Under Rini's patient instruction, Habu rehearsed the hand movements and body positions that commanded the microprocessors. He learned quickly, and she was reminded again of how children learned the net. Most adults, when confronted with a new task, tried to think their way through it, which often took them down blind alleys when their logical models failed to match the new circumstances. But for all his obvious intelligence, Habu took to VR in a far more intuitive way. Instead of setting out to make a particular thing and then trying to force the machinery to enact his ideas, he let the microprocessors and the software show him what they could do, then continued in the directions that interested him. As they watched his first attempts to control shape and color appear and then disappear in midair, he asked her,
"But why all this labor and expense to counterfeit? Is that the word? Why should we counterfeit reality at all?"
Rini hesitated.
"Well, by learning to counterfeit reality, we can make things that cannot exist except in our imaginations, just as artists have always done, or make something to show what we would like to create, as builders do when they draw a plan. But also, we can create for ourselves an environment that is more comfortable in which to work, just as this program takes a hand gesture."
She waved her arm.
A puff of white appeared in the sky overhead, and makes a cloud. It can take the same hand gesture and move a large amount of information from one place to another, or go and find some other information. Instead of hunching at a keyboard or a touch screen, as we used to do, we can sit or stand or lie down, point or wave or talk. Using the machines on which our lives depend can be made as easy as...
She paused, trying to find a simile. "As making a fish spear." His voice was oddly inflected. "So we seem to have come in a full circle. We complicate our life with machines, then struggle to make it as simple as it was before we had them. Have we gained anything, Ms. Sulaweo?"
Rini felt obscurely attacked.
"Our powers are greater. We can do many more things."
"Can we talk to the gods and hear their voices more clearly? Or have we now, with all these powers, become gods?"
Habu's change of tone had caught her off balance. As she struggled to give him a reasonable answer, he spoke again.
"Look here, Ms. Sulaweo. What do you think?"
A small and somewhat hard-angled flower had poked up from the simulated forest floor. It did not look like any flower she knew, but it had a certain vibrancy she found compelling. It seemed almost more a work of art than an attempt to imitate a real plant. Its velvety petals were blood-red.
It's very good for a first try, Habu.
You are a very good teacher.
He snapped his clumsy gray fingers, and the flower disappeared. She turned and pointed. A shelf of volumes leaped forward so she could read the titles.
Shit,
she whispered.
Wrong again. I can't remember the name. Find anything with spatial development or spatial rendering and child or juvenile in the title.
Three volumes appeared, floating before the library shelves.
Analysis of spatial rendering and juvenile development,
she read.
Right. Give me a list in order of most occurrences of...
Rini!
She whirled at the sound of her brother's disembodied voice, exactly as she would have in the real world.
Stephen, where are you?
Eddie's house. But we're having a problem.
There was an edge of fear. Rini felt her pulse speed. What kind of problem? Something at the house? Somebody giving you trouble?
No, not at the house.
He sounded as miserable as when he'd been thrown in the canal by older kids on his way home from school.
We're on the net. Can you come help us?
Stephen, what is wrong? Tell me right now.
We're in the inner district. Come quick!
The contact was gone.
Weenie pressed her fingertips together twice, and her library disappeared. For a moment, while her rig had no input to chew, she hovered in pure gray net space.
She quickly waved up her basic starting grid, then attempted to jump straight to her brother's present location. But she was blocked by a no-access warning. He was in the inner district, and in a subscription-only area. No wonder he hadn't wanted to stay in contact very long. He had been running up connection time on someone else's tab, probably his school's, and any large access group kept an eye open for just such leakage.
God damn that boy!
Did he expect her to hack into a big commercial system? There were penalties for that, and some of them could involve jail time for trespassing. Not to mention what the Polytechnic would think if one of its instructors were caught in that kind of undergraduate foolery. But he had sounded so frightened.
Damn,
she said again, then sighed and started working on her alias. Everyone entering Inner District was required to wear a simuloid. No invisible lurkers were allowed to trouble the Net's elite. Weenie would have preferred to have appeared in the bare minimum, a faceless, sexless object like a pedestrian on a traffic sign. But a rudimentary sim bespoke poverty, and nothing would attract attention faster at the Inner District gateway. She settled for an androgynous efficiency sim that she hoped had just enough in the way of facial expression and body articulation to make her appear some rich net baron's errand runner. The expense, filtered through several layers of accounting, should wind up in the backwaters of the Polytechnic's operating budget. If she could get in and out fast enough, the amount shouldn't attract anyone's attention. She hated the risk, though, and hated the dishonesty even more. When she found Stephen and dragged him out again, she was going to give him a serious scorching, but he had sounded so frightened. The inner district gateway was a glowing rectangle set in the base of what appeared to be a mile-high wall of white granite, daylit despite the lack of a visible sun anywhere in the bowl of simulated black sky. A swirl of figures were waiting to be processed, some wearing wild body shapes and bright colors. There was a particular type of lurker who stood around the gateway despite having no hope of entry, as though the inner district were a club that might suddenly decide the house wasn't interesting enough that night. But most were as functionally embodied as Rini, and all of them were constrained to approximately human dimensions. It was ironic that where the concentration of wealth and power on the net were greatest, things slowed down to something like the restrictive pace of the real world. In her library, or in the Polly's information net, she could jump with a single gesture to any place she wanted, or just as quickly construct whatever she needed. But the inner district and other centers of influence forced users into sims, and then treated the sims just like real people, herding them into virtual offices and checkpoints, forcing them to idle for excruciatingly long periods of time, while their connection costs mounted and mounted. If politicians ever find a way to tax light, she thought sourly, they'll probably set up waiting rooms for sunbeam inspection, too. She took up a position in line behind a hunched gray thing, a lowest-order sim whose slumped shoulders suggested an expectation of refusal. After what seemed an insufferable wait, the sim before her was duly rejected, and she at last found herself standing before one of the most cartoonish-looking functionaries she had ever seen. He was small and rodent-faced, with a pair of old-fashioned glasses pinching the end of his nose, and a pair of small, suspicious eyes peering over them. Surely he must be a puppet, she thought, a program given the appearance of humanity. No one could look so much like a petty bureaucrat, or if they did, would perpetuate it on the net, where one could appear as anything he or she desired.
Purpose in inner district?
Even his voice was tight as kazoo music, as though he spoke through something other than the normal orifice.
Delivery to Johanna Bundazi.
The chancellor of the Polytechnic, as Rini knew, kept a small node in the inner district. The functionary looked at her balefully for a long moment. Somewhere, processors processed.
Ms. Bundazi is not in residence.
I know.
She did know, too. She had been very careful.
I've been asked to hand-deliver something to her node.
Why? She's not here. Surely it would be better to send it to the node she is currently accessing.
Another brief moment.
She is not available at the moment on any node.
Rini tried to keep her temper. This must be a puppet. The simulation of bureaucratic small-mindedness was too perfect.
All I know is that I was asked to deliver it to her inner district node. Why she wants to make sure it has been directly uploaded is her affair. Unless you have contrary instructions, let me do my job.
Why does the sender need hand delivery when she's not accessing there?
I don't know. and you don't need to know either. Shall I go back, then, and you can tell Miss Bundazi you refuse to allow her a delivery?"
The functionary squinted as though he were searching a real human face for signs of duplicity or dangerous tendencies. Weenie was glad to be shielded by the sim mask.
"Yeah, go ahead and try to read me, you officious bastard."
"Very well," he said at last. "You have 20 minutes.
Which Weenie knew was the absolute minimum access time. A deliberate bit of unpleasantness.
What if there are return instructions? What if she's left a message dealing with this, and I need to take something else to somewhere in the district?
Weenie suddenly wished this were a game, and she could lift a laser gun and blast the puppet to shards.
20 minutes!
He raised a short-fingered hand to stifle further protest.
19 minutes, 56 seconds now. And counting. If you need more, you'll have to reapply.
She began to move away,
then turned back to the rat-faced man, occasioning a grunt of protest from the next supplicant, who had finally reached the Holy Land.
"Are you a puppet?"
Weenie demanded. Some of the others in line muttered in surprise. It was a very rude question, but one that law mandated must be answered. The functionary squared his narrow shoulders, indignant.
"I am a citizen. Do you want my number?"
Jesus mercy, he was a real person after all.
"No," she said, "just curious."
She cursed herself for pushing things, but a woman could only take so much. Unlike the careful mimicry of real life elsewhere in the inner district, there was no illusion of passing through the gate. A few moments after her admission was confirmed, Weenie was simply deposited in Gateway Plaza, a huge and depressingly neo-fascist mass of simulated stone, a flat expanse which appeared to be the size of a small country, surrounded by towering arches from which spoke roads radiated into the distance in a deceptively straightforward-seeming way. It was an illusion, of course. A few minutes' walk down one would get you somewhere, but it wouldn't necessarily be anywhere you could see from the plaza, and it wouldn't necessarily be a broad, straight avenue, or even a street at all. Despite its immense size, the plaza was more crowded and more rambunctious than the waiting area beyond the gateway. People here were inside, even if only temporarily, and it lent a certain air of purpose and pride to their movements. And if they had the leisure to travel through the plaza at all, to imitate real life to that extent, they probably had good reason to feel proud. The lowest-level admittees, like herself, weren't given the time for anything but instantaneous travel to and from their destinations. It was a place worth lingering in. The actual citizens of the inner district, those who had the money and power to commandeer their own private space in this elite section of the net, did not have the same restraints on their sims as visitors. In the distance, Weenie could see a pair of naked men with incredibly bulging muscles, who also both happened to be bright candy-apple red and 30 feet tall. She wondered what the upkeep on those must have been, just in taxes and connection costs alone. It was much costlier to move a non-standard body through the simulations.
New rich,
she decided. On the few other occasions she had managed to get into inner district, usually hacking in as a student net girl, but twice as someone's legitimate guest, she had been delighted just to sightsee. Inner district was, of course, unique, the first true world city. Its population, simulated though it might be, was made up of planet Earth's 10 million or so most influential citizens, or so the district's clientele clearly believed, and they went to great lengths to justify that contention. The things they built for themselves were wonderful. In a place without gravity, or even the necessity of normal geometry, and with highly flexible zoning laws in the private sectors, human creative ingenuity had flowered in most spectacular ways. Structures that would have been buildings in the real world, and thus subject to mundane laws, could here dispense with such irrelevant considerations as up and down and size-to-weight ratios. They needed only to serve as nodes, and so blazing displays of computer design appeared overnight, and often disappeared as quickly, wild and colorful as jungle flowers. Even now she paused for a moment to admire an impossibly thin, translucent green skyscraper rising high into the sky beyond the arches. She thought it quite beautiful and unusually restrained, a knitting needle of solid jade. If the things they built for themselves were spectacular, these denizens of the innermost circle of humanity, the things they made of themselves were no less so.
in a place where the only absolute requirement was to exist, and only budget, good taste, and common courtesy limited invention, and some district habitués were notoriously long on the first and short on the other two, just the passers-by promenading along the major thoroughfares made for an endless and endlessly varied show, from the extremes of current fashion, elongated heads and limbs seemed to be a current trend, to the replication of real things and people. Weenie had seen three different Hitlers on her first trip to the district, one of them wearing a ball gown made of blue orchids. On out to the realms of design, where the fact of a body was only a starting point, the district was a non-stop parade. In the early days, tourists who had bought their way in with a holiday package had often sat at sidewalk cafes gawping for hours until, like the most junior of netboys, their real meat bodies collapsed from hunger and thirst, and their simulations froze solid or winked out. It was easy to understand why. There was always one more thing to see, one more fabulous oddity appearing in the distance. But she was here today for only one purpose, to find Stephen. Meanwhile, she was running up a bill on the Polly's account, and she had now incurred the wrath of a nasty little man at the gateway. Thinking of this, she programmed Chancellor Bundazi's delivery for entry plus 19 minutes, since she knew Mr. I Am a Citizen would be checking up. The delivery was actually a piece of department mail addressed to the Chancellor, one of no import. She had swapped its bill of lading with something actually addressed for hand delivery to one of Ms. Bundazi's other notes, and she hoped the resultant confusion would be blamed on the mailroom, actually a 2-decades-out-of-date electronic mail system, which certainly could never be blamed too much. Trying to get something through the Polly's internal delivery system was like trying to push butter through stone. After a moment's examination of Stephen's message coordinates, Weenie jumped to Lullaby Lane, the main thoroughfare of Toytown, a backwater sector which housed the smaller and less successful creative firms and merchants, as well as the residential nodes of those clinging to inter-district status by their fingernails. A subscription to the inter-district net was very expensive, and so were the creative fashions necessary to retain one's place among the elite. But even if you couldn't afford a new and exotic sim every day, even if you couldn't afford to redesign your business or personal node every week, just keeping inter-district residency was still major social cachet in the real world. These days, it was often the last pretension that the downwardly mobile would relinquish, and they did not give it up easily. Weenie could not immediately locate the signal source, so she slowed herself down to what would have been a walking pace, except her stripped-down sim did nothing as expensively, uselessly complicated as walking. Toytown's fringe status was apparent everywhere around her. Most of the nodes were functional in the extreme, white, black, or gray boxes that served no other purpose than to separate one struggling citizen's enterprise from another's. Some of the other nodes had been quite grand once, but now their styles were hopelessly outdated. Some were even beginning to disappear, the more expensive visual functions sacrificed so the owner could cling to the space. She passed one large node, built to resemble something out of Fritz Lang's Metropolis. Ancient science fiction had been a district fad almost a decade ago, which was now entirely transparent, the great dome a polyhedral skeleton, all its detail work gone, its once magnificent colors and textures switched off. There was only one node on Lullaby Lane that looked both contemporary and expensive, and it was very near the source point of Stephen's message. The virtual structure was a huge Gothic mansion, covering an area the size of a couple of real-world city blocks, spiky with turrets and as labyrinthine as a termite nest. Colored lights flashed from the windows, deep red, dull chalky purple, and seizure-inducing white. A thick rumble of music advertised that this was some kind of club, as did the shifting letters that moved along the facade like gleaming snakes, spelling out in English, and apparently also in Japanese, Chinese, Arabic, and a few other alphabets, Mr. J's. In the midst of the writhing letters, appearing and then immediately vanishing, as though the Cheshire Cat were having an indecisive day, was a vast, toothy, disembodied grin. She remembered the name of the place. Stephen had mentioned it. This was what had drawn them into the inner district, or at least into this part of it. She stared, appalled and fascinated. It was easy to see its allure. Every carefully shadowed angle, every light-leaking window screamed out that here was escape. Here was freedom, especially freedom from disapproval. Here was a haven where everything was permitted. The thought of her 11-year-old brother in such a place sent a cold bolt of fear up her spine. But if that was where he was, that was where she would go.
Weenie, up here!
It was a quiet cry, as though from somewhere close. Stephen was trying to narrowcast, but he didn't realize there was no such thing as narrowcasting in the district, unless you could pay for privacy. If someone wanted to hear, they'd hear. So speed was the only thing that mattered now.
Where are you? Are you in this club?
No, across the street, in the building with the cloth thing on the front.
She turned to look. Some distance down, on the opposite of Lullaby Lane from Mr. J's, was what looked like the shell of an old toy town hotel, a soothing simulation of a real-world resting place designed for district tourists, a spot to receive messages and plan day trips. They had been more popular in the early days, when VR was a slightly intimidating novelty. This one's heyday was obviously long over. The walls had lost color definition, and were actually erased in some spots. Over its wide front door hung an awning, unmoving when it should have undulated in a simulated breeze, dulled, like the rest of the structure, to a state of minimal existence. Reeny moved to the doorway. Then, after a brief survey suggested there was no longer anything in the way of security, moved inside. The interior was even more forsaken than the exterior, time and neglect having reduced it to a warehouse of phantom cubes stacked like discarded toy blocks. A few better manufactured sim objects had maintained their integrity, and stood out in eerie contrast. The front desk was one of these, a shimmering block of neon blue marble. She found Stephen and his friend Eddie behind it.
What the hell are you playing at?
Both of them were wearing schoolnet sims, scarcely even as detailed as hers, but she could still tell from Stephen's face that he was terrified. He scrambled up and grabbed her around the waist. Only the hands of her sim were wired for force feedback, but she knew he was squeezing hard.
They're after us,
Stephen said breathlessly.
People from the club. Eddie has a blanket shield, and we've been using that to hide, but it's just a cheap one, and they're going to find us soon.
Since you told me you were in here, anyone who cares around here knows it, too.
She turned to Eddie.
And where in God's name did you get a blanket? No, don't tell me. Not now.
She reached down and carefully dislodged Stephen. It was strange to feel his slender arm between her fingers when she knew that their true bodies were on opposite sides of town in the real world. But it was that sort of miracle that had led her to the VR field in the first place.
We'll talk later, and I've got lots of questions. But for now, we'll get you out of here before you get us all sent before a magistrate.
Eddie finally spoke.
But, Soki...
Soki what?
Weenie said impatiently.
Is he here too?
He's still in Mr. J's.
Sort of. Eddie appeared to have run out of nerve. Stephen finished for him.
Soki, he fell into a hole. Kind of a hole. When we tried to get him out, these men came. I think they were puppets.
His voice trembled.
They were real scary.
Reenie shook her head.
I can't do anything about Soki. I'm running out of time, and I'm not going to trespass in a private club. If he gets caught, he gets caught. If he tells who was with him, then you'll have to face the music. Net boy lesson number one. You get what you deserve.
But they might hurt him.
Hurt him? Scare him, maybe. And that's no more than you lot deserve. But no one's going to hurt him.
She grabbed Eddie, so she now held both boys by the arm. Back in the Polly's processors, her escape algorithm added too.
And we're going to...
There was a thunderous crash, nearly as loud as the bomb at the Polly. So loud that at the apex of its roar, Reenie's earplugs could not deliver it, and went mercifully silent for an instant. The front of the hotel dissolved into swirling motes of net stuff. A huge shadow loomed between them and the Toy Town street. Something far bigger than most normal Sims. That was about all she could tell. There was something about it, something dark and arrhythmically wavery in its display pattern, that made it almost impossible to look at.
Jesus!
Weenie's ears were ringing. That would teach her to leave the gain up on her plugs.
Jesus!
For a moment she stood frozen as the shape loomed over her, a brilliantly realized abstract expression of the concepts big and dangerous. Then she squeezed the boys tightly and exited the system.
We got into Mr. J's. Everybody does it at school.
Leenie stared at her brother across the kitchen table. She had been worried for him, even frightened. But now anger was pushing the other emotions aside. Not only had he put her to a great deal of trouble, but then it had taken him an hour longer to get home from Eddie's flat block than it had taken her to return from the poly, forcing her to wait.
I don't care if everybody does it, Stephen, and I seriously doubt that's true anyway. I'm really scorched. It's illegal for you to enter the district, and we truly couldn't afford the fines if you got caught. Plus, if my boss finds out what I did to get you out, I could get fired.
She leaned forward and grabbed his hand, squeezing until he winced.
I could lose my job, Stephen.
Shut up there, you fool children,
their father called out from the back bedroom.
You making my head hurt.
If there had not been a door between them, Reenie's look might have set Long Joseph's sheets on fire.
I'm sorry, Reenie. I'm really sorry. Really. Could I try Soki again?
Without waiting for permission, he turned to the wall screen and told it to call. No one answered at Soki's end. Reenie tried to rein in her temper.
What was this about Soki falling down a hole?
Stephen drummed his fingers nervously on the table.
Eddie dared him. Dared him to do what? Damn it, Stephen, don't make me drag this out of you word by word. There's this room in Mr. J's. Some guys from school told us about it. They have, well, there's things in there that are real chiz.
Things? What things?
Just things. Stuff to see.
Stephen wouldn't meet her eyes.
But we didn't see it, Reenie. We couldn't find it. The club is major big on the inside. You wouldn't believe it. It goes on forever.
For a moment, his eyes sparkled. As, remembering the glory that was Mr. J's, he forgot that he was in serious trouble. A look at his sister's face reminded him.
Anyway, we were looking and looking, and we asked people. I think they were mostly citizens, but some acted really weird. But no one could tell us. Then someone, this farm major fat guy, said you could get in through this room down in the basement.
Reenie suppressed a shiver of distaste.
Before you tell me any more, young man, I want one thing clear. You are never going back to this place again. Understand? Look me in the eye. Never.
Reluctantly, Stephen nodded.
Okay, okay. I won't. So we went down all these windy stairs. It was like a dungeon game. And after a while, found this door. Soki opened it and fell through.
Fell through what?
I don't know. It was just like a big hole on the other side. There was smoke and some blue lights down deep inside it.
Reenie sat back in her chair.
Someone's nasty, sadistic little trick. You all deserve to be scared, but I hope it didn't scare him too much. Was he using bootleg school net equipment like you two?
No, just his home setup, a cheap Nigerian station,
which was what their own family owned. How could kids be poor and still be so damn snobbish?
Well, then there won't have been much vertigo or gravity simulation. He'll be fine.
She stared narrowly at Stephen.
You did hear me, didn't you? You're never going there again, or you will have no station time and no visits to Eddie or Soki forever, instead of just for the rest of the month.
What?
Stephen leaped up in outrage.
No net!
End of the month. You're lucky I haven't told Dad. You'd be getting a belt across your troublesome black behind.
I'd rather have that than no net,
he said sullenly.
You'd be getting both.
After she sent Stephen grumbling and complaining to his room, Reenie accessed her work library, making sure that her inbox contained no memos from Ms. Bundazi about defrauding the poly, and called up some files on inter-district businesses. She found Mr. J's, registered as a gaming and entertainment club, and licensed strictly for adult visitors. It was owned by something called the Happy Juggler Novelty Corporation, and had first been opened under the name Mr. Jingo's Smile. As she waited for sleep that night, she was visited by images of the club's ramshackle facade, of turrets like pointed idiot heads and windows like staring eyes. Hardest of all to escape was the memory of the huge mobile mouth and rows of gleaming teeth that squirmed above the door, a gateway that only led inward. Chapter 2. The Airman. Netfeed, music. Drone, bigger than ever. Visual, one eye. V.O.
Ganga drone music will be bigger than ever this year, according to one of its leading practitioners.
Visual, half of face, glinting teeth.
Ayatollah Jones, who sings and plays Nero Cythera for the drone group Your First Heart Attack, told us,
Jones,
it's gonna be big, mordo big, bigger than,
visual, fingers twining, many rings, cosmetic webbing, Jones,
than ever, no dupping, real big.
Christabel Sorensen was not a good liar, but with a little practice, she was getting better. She wasn't a bad girl, really, although once her fish died because she forgot to feed him for a bunch of days. She didn't think of herself as a liar, either. But sometimes it was just easier not to tell. So when her mother asked her where she was going, she smiled and said, Portia has Otterland. It's new, and it's just like you're really swimming, except you can breathe, and there's an otter king and an otter queen. Her mother waved a hand to halt the explanation.
That sounds sweet, darling. Don't stay at Portia's too long. Daddy's going to be home for dinner. For once,
Christabel grinned. Daddy worked too much.
Mommy always said so.
He had an important job as base security supervisor. Christabel didn't know exactly what it meant. He was sort of a policeman, except with the army. But he didn't wear a uniform like the army men in the movies.
Can we have ice cream?
If you come home in time to help me shell the peas, then we'll have ice cream.
Okay?
Christabel trotted out. As the door resealed behind her with its familiar sucking sound, she laughed. Some noises were just funny. She knew that the base was different than the kind of towns that people lived in on net shows, or even in other parts of North Carolina. But she didn't know why. It had streets and trees and a park and a school. Two schools, really, since there was a school for grown-up army men and army women, as well as one for kids like Christabel, whose parents lived on the base. Daddies and mommies went off to work in normal clothes, drove cars, mowed their lawns, had each other over for dinners and parties and barbecues. The base did have a few things that most towns didn't have. A double row of electric fences all the way around it to keep out the crowded hammock city beyond the trees. And three different little houses called checkpoints that all the cars coming in had to drive past. But that didn't seem like enough to make it a base instead of just a normal place to live. The other kids at school had lived on bases all their lives, just like her, so they didn't get it either. She turned left on Windicott Lane. If she had really been going to Porsche's, she would have turned right. So she was glad the street corner was out of sight of her house, just in case her mother was watching. It was strange telling Mom she was going one place and then going somewhere else. It was bad, she knew, but not really bad, and it was very exciting. She felt all trembly and new every time she did it. Like a shiver-legged baby colt she had seen on the net. From Windicott, she turned onto Stillwell. She skipped for a while, being careful not to step on any of the sidewalk cracks, then turned onto Redland. The houses here were definitely smaller than hers. Some of them looked a little sad. The grass was short on the lawns, like everywhere else on the base, but it looked like it was that way because it didn't have the strength to grow any higher. Some of the lawns had bare spots, and lots of the houses were dusty and a bit faded. She wondered why the people living in them didn't just wash them off or paint them so they'd look like new. When she had her own house someday, she would paint it a different color every week. She thought about different colors of houses all the way down Redland, then skipped again as she crossed the footbridge over the creek. She liked the ka-thump, ka-thump sound it made, and hurried down Beekman Court, where the trees were very thick. Even though Mr. Sellers' house was very close to the fence that marked the outskirts of the base, you could hardly tell, because the trees and hedges blocked the view. That had been the first thing that attracted her to the house, of course. The trees. There were sycamores in the backyard of her parents' house, and a papery-barked birch tree by the front window. But Mr. Sellers' house was absolutely surrounded by trees, so many of them that you could hardly see that there was a house there at all. The first time she had seen it, helping Ophelia Weiner look for her runaway cat, Dickens, she had thought it was just like something in a fairy tale. When she came back later and walked up the twisty gravel driveway, she had almost expected it to be made out of gingerbread. It wasn't, of course. It was just a little house like all the others. But it was still a very interesting place. And Mr. Sellers was a very interesting man. She didn't know why her parents didn't want her to go to his house anymore, and they wouldn't tell her. He was a little scary-looking, but that wasn't his fault. Christabel stopped skipping so she could better appreciate the crunchy feeling of walking down Mr. Sellers' long driveway. It was pretty silly having a driveway at all, since the big car in his garage hadn't been moved in years.
Mr. Sellers didn't even go out of the house. She'd asked him once why he had a car, and he had laughed kind of sad and said it came with the house.
"If I'm very, very good," he had told her, "some day they may let me get into that Cadillac, little Christabel. I'll close the garage door real tight and drive home."
She thought it had been a joke, but she didn't really get it. Grown-up jokes were like that sometimes. But then grown-ups seldom laughed at the jokes that Uncle Jingle did on his net show. And those were so funny, and kind of naughty, although she didn't know why exactly, that Christabel sometimes almost wet her pants from laughing. To find the doorbell, she had to push aside one of the ferns, which had practically covered the front porch. Then she had to wait a long time. At last, Mr. Sellers' strange voice came from behind the door, all hooty and soft.
"Who is it?"
"Christabel."
The door opened and wet air came out, along with the thick green smell of the plants. She stepped inside quickly so Mr. Sellers could shut it again. He had told her the first time she came that it was bad for him if he let too much of the moisture out.
"Well, little Christabel,"
he seemed very pleased to see her.
"And to what do I owe this enchanting surprise?"
"I told Mommy I was going to Portia's to play Outerland."
He nodded. He was so tall and bent over that sometimes when he nodded like that, up and down so hard, she was worried he might hurt his skinny neck.
"Ah, then we can't take too long having our visit, can we? Still, might as well do it upright and proper. You know where to change. I think there's something there to fit you."
He rolled his wheelchair back out of her way, and she hurried down the hall. He was right. They didn't have very long, unless she wanted to risk having her mother phone Portia's to hurry her back to the P's. Then she'd have to think of a story about why she didn't go play Outerland. That was the problem about lying. If people started checking up, things got very complicated. The changing room was, like every room in the house, full of plants. She had never seen so many in one place, not even at Mrs. Gullison's house. And Mrs. Gullison was always bragging about her plants and how much work they were, even though a little dark-skinned man came 2 times a week to do all the clipping and watering and digging. But Mr. Sellers' plants, although they got plenty of water, never got clipped at all. They just grew. Sometimes she wondered if they would fill the whole house someday, and the funny old man would have to move out. There was a bathrobe in just her size hanging on the hook behind the door. She quickly took off her shorts and shirt, socks and shoes, and put them all in the plastic bag, just as Mr. Sellers had shown her. As she bent over to put the last shoe in, one of the ferns tickled her back. She squealed.
"Are you all right, little Christabel?"
called Mr. Sellers.
"Yes, your plant tickled me."
"I'm sure it did no such thing."
He pretended to be angry, but she knew he was joking.
"My plants are the best behaved on the base."
She belted the terry-cloth bathrobe and stepped into the shower thongs. Mr. Sellers was sitting in his chair next to the machine that put all the water in the air. He looked up as she came in, and his twisted face moved in a smile.
"Ah, it's good to see you."
The first time she had seen that face, she had been frightened. The skin was not just wrinkled like on Grandma's face, but looked almost melted, like the wax on the side of a burned-down candle. He had no hair either, and his ears were just nubs that stood out from the side of his head. But he had told her that first time that it was all right to be scared. He knew what he looked like. It was from a bad burn, he said, an accident with jet fuel. It was even okay to stare, he had told her, and she had stared. And for weeks after their first meeting, his melted doll face had been in her dreams. But he had been very nice, and Christabel knew he was lonely. How sad to be an old man and to have a face that people would point at and make fun of, and to need to be in a house where the air was always cool and wet so that his skin didn't hurt. He deserved a friend. She didn't like telling lies about it, but what else could she do? Her parents had told her not to visit him anymore, but for no good reason. Christabel was almost grown up now. She wanted to know reasons for things.
"So, little Christabel, tell me about the world."
Mr. Sellers sat back in the streaming mist of the moisture machine. Christabel told him about her school, about Ophelia Weiner, who thought she was really special because she had a nanu dress that she could change into a different shape or color by pulling on it, and about playing Otterland with Portia.
"And you know how the Otter King can always tell if you have a fish with you? By smelling you?"
She looked at Mr. Sellers. With his eyes closed, his bumpy, hairless face seemed like a clay mask. As she wondered if he had fallen asleep, his eyes popped open again. They were the most interesting color, yellow like Dickens the cat's.
"I'm afraid I don't know the ins and outs of the Otter Kingdom very well, my young friend. A failing, I realize."
"Didn't they have it when you were a boy?"
He laughed, a soft pigeon coo.
"Not really. No, nothing quite like Otterland."
She looked at his rippled face and felt something like the love she felt for her mother and father.
"Was it scary when you were a pilot, back in the old days?"
His smile went away.
"It was scary sometimes, yes. And sometimes it was very lonely. But it was what I was raised to do, Christabel. I knew it from the time I was a little boy. It was my duty, and I was proud to perform it."
His face went a little strange, and he bent over to fiddle with his water machine.
"No, there was more to it than that. There is a poem. Nor law nor duty made me fight, nor public men nor cheering crowds. A lonely impulse of delight drove to this tumult in the clouds. I balanced all, brought all to mind. The years to come seemed waste of breath, a waste of breath the years behind, in balance with this life, this death."
He coughed.
"That's Yeats. It's always hard to say just what makes us choose to do something, especially something we're afraid to do."
Christabel didn't know what Yeats were, and didn't understand what the poem meant. But she didn't like it when Mr. Sellers looked so sad.
"I'm going to be a doctor when I grow up," she said.
Earlier in the year, she'd thought she might be a dancer or a singer on the net. But now she knew better.
"Do you want me to tell you where I'm going to have my office?"
The old man was smiling again.
"I'd love to hear about it. But aren't you running a little late?"
Christabel looked down. Her wristband was blinking. She jumped up.
"I have to go change. But I wanted you to tell me more of the story."
"Next time, my dear. We don't want you to get into trouble with your mother. I'd hate to be denied your company in the future."
"I wanted you to finish telling me about Jack."
She hurried into the changing room and put her clothes back on. The plastic bag had kept them dry, just like it was supposed to.
"Ah, yes,"
Mr. Sellers said when she returned.
"And what was Jack doing when we stopped?"
"He climbed up the beanstalk and he was in the giant's castle."
Christabel was faintly offended that he didn't remember.
"And the giant was coming back soon."
"Ah, so he was, so he was. Poor Jack. Well, that's where we shall begin when you come back to visit me next time. Now on your way."
He carefully patted her head. The way his face looked, she thought it might hurt his hand to touch her. But he always did it. She was most of the way out the door when she remembered something she wanted to ask him about his plants. She turned and came back, but Mr. Sellers had closed his eyes again and sunk back into his chair. His long, spidery fingers were moving slowly, as though he were finger-painting on the air. She stared for a moment. She had never seen that before, and thought maybe it was some special exercise he had to do, then realized that clouds of steam were drifting past her into the hot afternoon air. She quickly went out again and pulled the door closed behind her. The exercises, if that was what they were, had seemed private and a little of creepy. He had been moving his hands in the air like someone who was on the net, she suddenly realized. But Mr. Sellers hadn't been wearing a helmet or one of those wires in his neck like some of the people who worked for her daddy. He had just had his eyes closed. Her wristband was blinking even faster. Christabel knew it would be only a few more minutes before her mother called Portia's house. She didn't waste time skipping as she went back over the footbridge. Chapter 3. Empty Signal Gray. Netfeed News. Asia's leaders declare prosperity zone. Visual, Empress Palace, Singapore City. VO. Asian politicians and business leaders meeting in Singapore, led by aging and reclusive Chinese financier Jun Bao and Singapore's Prime Minister Lo... Visual, Lo Wee Kwa and Jun Bao shaking hands, agreed on a historical trade agreement which Jun calls a prosperity zone that would give Asia an unprecedented economic unity. Visual, Jun Bao, supported by aides at press lectern. Jun,
the time has come. The future belongs to a united Asia. We are full of hope, but we know there is hard work ahead.
It stretched before them from horizon to horizon.
its millions of byways like scratches on glass under extreme magnification. But in every one of those scratches, lights flickered, and minute objects moved.
There cannot be any place so big.
But it's not a place, remember. Not a real place. The whole thing is just electronic impulses on a chain of very powerful computers. It can be as big as the programmers can imagine. Habu was silent for a long moment. They hung side by side, twin stars floating in an empty black sky, two angels gazing down from heaven at the immensity of humankind's commercial imagination.
The girl arose, Habu said at last. She put her hands into the wood ashes.
What?
It is a poem, or a story, made by one of my people. The girl arose. She put her hands into the wood ashes. She threw the ashes up into the sky. She said to them, "The wood ashes which are here, they must together become the Milky Way. They must lie white along the sky."
He stopped as if embarrassed.
"It is something of my childhood. It is called the girl of the early race who made the stars. Being here, what you have done, they brought it back to me."
Now Rini was embarrassed too, although she was not quite sure why. She flexed her fingers to take them instantly down to ground level. Lambda Mall, the main trade ground of the entire net, surrounded them completely. The mall was a nation-sized warren of simulated shopping districts, a continent of information with no shore. Millions of commercial nodes blinked, shimmied, rainbowed, and sang, doing their best to separate customers from credits. The intricate web of virtual thoroughfares surged with sims of every visual type, every level of complexity.
"It is a huge place," she said. "But remember that most people never bother with high-level overviews like the one we just had. They just travel directly to wherever it is they want to go. If you tried to visit every node on the net, or even just every node in this mall, well, it would be like trying to call every single address in the Greater Beijing Directory. Even all these," she indicated the crush of sims moving around them in endless parade, "are just a tiny fraction of the people who are using the mall right now. These are just the folk who want to have the visual experience of browsing and people-watching."
"The visual experience?"
Habu's gray simuloid swiveled to watch a flock of furries push through the crowd. Cartoon voluptuous females with animal heads.
"Like you're doing now. There's plenty to see. But it's much faster just to go directly to what you want. When you're using the regular computer interface, do you read the name of every file in storage?"
Habu was slow to respond. The furries had met a pair of snake-headed men and were going through an elaborate ritual greeting which featured a great deal of sniffing.
"Go to what I want?"
"I'll show you. Let's say we want to, I don't know, buy a new data pad. Well, if you know where the electronics district is, you could go there directly and then physically move around. People spend a lot of money trying to make their commercial nodes attractive, just like in the real world. But let's say you don't even know where the district is."
He had turned to face her. His gray face, with its vestigial features, caused her a moment of anxiety. She missed his animation, his smile. This was like traveling with a scarecrow. Of course, she herself must not look any more pleasant.
"But it's true," he said. "I do not know where the electronics district is."
"Right. Look, you've spent a lot of time in the past few weeks learning to find your way around the basic computer setup. The only difference here is that you're inside the computer, or apparently so."
"It is hard to remember that I have a real body, and that it is back at the Polytechnic, that I am still in the Polytechnic."
"That's the magic."
She made her voice smile, since she couldn't do much with her face.
"Now, do a search."
Habu moved his fingers slowly. A glowing blue orb appeared in front of him.
"Good."
Rini took a step closer.
"No one can see that but you and me. That's part of our interaction with our own computer at the Poly. But we're going to use our computer to access the mall's service directory."
She showed him the procedure.
"Go ahead and bring up the list. You can do voice commands, too, either offline, where no one will hear them but you, or online. If you keep an eye open here in the mall, you'll see lots of people talking to themselves. They might just be crazy. There are more than a few. But they may also be talking to their own systems, and not bothering to keep it private."
The orb spat out a list of services, which hovered in mid-air as lines of fiery blue letters. Rini adjusted the list to sunset red, more readable against the background.
then pointed at those listed under electronics. There you go. Personal access devices. Click it. The world immediately changed. The open spaces of the mall's public area were replaced by a long, wide street. The simulated buildings on either side loomed high into the false sky, each one a riot of color and movement. The outside displays as colorful and competitive as tropical flowers. And we're the bees, she thought to herself, with pollen credits to spread around. Welcome to the information jungle. She rather liked the metaphor. Maybe she would use it in one of her lectures. Now, she said aloud, if you had found a particular store in the services directory, we could have beamed straight there. Beamed? Habu's head was tipped back on his simulated neck. It reminded her of how amazed she'd been by the displays when she had first traveled on the net. It used